Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. This is the second panel we've had. A lot of you were at the panel we had a couple months ago. It was at Clayton Utz. Thank you for coming again. We are again going to be talking about changes in the financial world. Again, we think this is an important topic. It's not covered usually by the academic research that you see in the Financial Analyst Journal, but it's something that's really changing rapidly all over the world, including in Australia. So we have a very, very strong panel here today. I'm going to introduce them in a moment. I just want to have a quick warm-up quiz before we start. We're going to be talking about investment advice today, and particularly automation and changes in it. Who here today uses robo-advice? Can I see a show of hands? I see one person brave enough to do it. Okay, good. That's one. Two people. Okay, that's good. Whose second question is, who considers that they work for a disruptive organization? An organization involved in a disruptive technology. We have one again. One half. Two. Three, four, five, six, seven. Okay, 7 out of 50. Still not that great. Question number three, who thinks that the organization that they work for should be a disruptive organization in this field, in investment advice and financial investment technology? We're not going to take names, so you can say it. One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay. Well, I would have expected more. Thank you. I would have expected more. I would expect more because you guys are here, so you must be interested in it. We want to keep this panel. I don't want to talk that much, so cut me off, and you guys cut me off if I do talk too much. But we want to talk about what's happening in this field. We want to focus on the technology, but we also want to focus on the big picture. One of the big changes. In technology over the past 5 years is that most people, when they're walking around, they used to sort of walk around and look where they're going. Most people walk around these days going like this. And so, you know, as they say, little screens, little thoughts. Actually, I just made that up. But we want to think big. We want to talk about big picture. We have a lot of people who are thinking big here. These are the panelists today. Okay, and we want to focus not only on what technology is doing, but how it can really improve the lives of ourselves, our clients, other people, why this works. So we're not really going to focus on whether Australia is the next technology hub and, you know, whether it's going to beat Singapore and Hong Kong and in the U.S. We're going to be talking about what works here, why it works, and why it's a benefit to people here, or why it could be. So the format is, again, I'm going to ask the panelists to introduce themselves and talk about their businesses very briefly, 2 minutes each. I'm sure they can do it in 2 minutes. I'm going to start with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 questions. Questions from the audience are encouraged. So please, if you have a question, as soon as we start, put your hand up and ask it. We want this to be interactive. And then we will have a section at the end for if you want to ask questions at the end of the panel, you can do that. Okay, so that's the format. I want to turn over the mic to these guys. Ben's got the mic first. If you could just talk about your business, Ben, to start, and how it is related to financial.
Sure. Thank you. So thanks, John, and thanks, everyone. My name's Ben Heap, and I run a small investment firm called H2 Ventures, and we're investing in financial services or fintech businesses, typically at the very early stage. So our model is to invest through what's often referred to as an accelerator, or some people talk about an incubator model. Our intention is to invest in 100 fintech businesses over the next 3 or 4 years. We invested in 11 last year, so we have a little bit of a track record in this space. I think this is a really interesting point of discussion. I was equally surprised to John's third question, which is who thinks they should be working in a disruptive business? Because I actually think you all should be working in a disruptive business. Frankly, I think It's a bit of a trait in financial services to take the view that financial services isn't necessarily as exposed to disruption as other industries, and I think that's a fundamentally flawed view. I think financial services is going to go through some really, really tremendous change. Tremendous could have different meanings there. I don't necessarily mean positive or negative, but those changes are fascinating, and hopefully today's discussion will bring some of those sort of thoughts out. We might hold questions until the other guys have introduced themselves, I think.
Thanks very much. Julian Plummer's my name. I'm a Managing Director of a company called Midwinter Financial Services, and what we do is financial planning software for advisors, traditionally. So what we do is we work with financial planners, institutions, banks, superannuation funds, aligned advisors, non-aligned advisors, and independent financial advisors to help them generate their advice, run their business, manage their practice, and engage with their clients. And so we have over 1,000 advisors using our software in some form or fashion. And what we're looking at doing over the next year or two is being able to give advisors the tools to be able to engage with their clients digitally and to be able to give advisors the tools to be able to compete with the banks and the fintech players in being able to produce self-help advice or robo-advice. So we're taking a big picture view of it. It's not just robo-advice for us. We're looking at the whole entire advice process, intra-fund advice, switching, contributions, retirement gap analysis, transitional retirements, those sort of things. So we're seeing a lot of opportunity out there as the industry changes and as we see the rise of mobile as becoming ubiquitous amongst the community. And we're seeing a lot of opportunity for advisors to be able to increase the quality of their advice and be able to increase their engagement with their clients.
Thanks, Julian. Hi, everyone. My name is Jason Clark. I'm representing a company, Recreo Financial Technologies, today. Recreo is a relatively new company, and as the name would suggest, we're looking to evolve, recreate financial technology for financial product in Australia. So our services provide technology and administration services predominantly for self-managed super funds, for managed discretionary accounts, IDPSs, you all know what that is, of course, your CFAs. Actually, there's a few people over there that don't look clever enough to be CFA. John, you might want to check their accreditation. And we're also providing technology and administration services for large institutional super funds. So the challenge for us with new technology as a B2B provider is to have institutions move away from their existing technology and their existing service, which is a little different to some of the other offerings. Our products are often intermediated by advisors, so the demands of advisors today and how that influences our technology builds is very interesting as well. John's asked me to come along today to represent Recreo and talk about financial technologies, but I also represent another company, Lonsec, which as a director there, that's a company that's 20 years old as opposed to one that's 20 months old at Recreo. And what's interesting for Lonsec as a leader in the market for research ratings and data, it has to defend its position from people who are trying to move into that space. So I can see two sides of disruption, one that you have to defend and one that you want to get on. So the questions today should be very interesting.
Do you feel conflicted, Jason? How can you sleep?
All day, every day, John. In that regard, no. They're two very complementary businesses, but the conflicts is that one, when you're really trying to hold a customer base, you've got to evolve with what's available. So that's often technology, people, or products. And then when trying to move into a market, your processes are much different. Your positioning and how you have to position your product and what tools you have to use to influence someone to take risk to move into something new is very different. I don't think they're conflicted. Learning from both environments.
There's no conflict, there's no interest.
That's right, Julian, yeah.
Okay, good. Well, I can see we've got a disruptive group of panelists already, so that's good. So I'm going to give you guys a softball question first. I mean, we we met early in the week. We started talking, and I said to the guys, after about 15 minutes, the guys, actually, we don't need to rehearse this. You guys could just talk amongst yourselves for an hour, and it would be very valuable. But I am going to just try to structure it a little bit and give you – the first question really is, okay, on – is where are we going with robo-advice? I mean, we've seen BlackRock this week buy a robo-advisor. We've seen Vanguard start a service globally, which is basically telephone advice. We've seen Wealthfront, Betterment. Some of the panelists can talk there. But what is going to happen in the financial advice world? What will happen with financial advisors? Will their role change, and how will it change?
So it's a deceptively simple question, quite tricky to answer.
I'm a deceptive person.
Yeah. So a couple of points. Firstly, it's worth just spending just a minute on robo-advice. So robo-advice to me is a turn of phrase like hedge fund, which means a multitude of different things to different people. And I think robo-advice is evolving the same sort of way. Everyone's got a definition of robo-advice. Everyone in one way or another has a robo-advice strategy, from all the banks to all the wealth providers to every firm. I think there's a sort of a distinction between what I might better call automated investing, which is what companies like Wealthfront and Betterment in the US and Nutmeg in the UK and StockSpot down here are trying to do, versus then this broader idea of robo-advice, which both Julian and Jason have a lot of sort of fingers in that space and they can talk to it. I just want to specifically answer that last question, John, which is, how's it going to change the world for, say, financial advisors or for firms? I don't necessarily know the answer. The good thing about what we're doing, backing 100 fintech startups, is actually, quite obviously, we don't know the answer. Otherwise, we'd put all our money in one of those startups. We think, though, in fact, we have a very high level of conviction that the world is going to change very significantly, very dramatically. And that will have significant winners and significant losers. And that's sort of back to the point I made in my sort of opening remarks that sitting stumm is definitely the wrong course of action. You actually have to have a strategy, and thinking what worked for the last 20 years will continue to probably isn't it.
That is the million-dollar question. What's going to happen to financial advisors in the face of robo-advice? So we deal with a lot of financial advisors, and the one thing we don't want to do is upset them while we're going out and trying to develop these robo-advice tools. And it is the great polarizer, I think, of today, robo-advice and how advisors feel about it. So what we did is we did a survey, and we put it out to, it was about 268 financial planners. What do you think? What's going to happen? How do you feel about it? And some of the results came back were actually quite encouraging. From an advisor's point of view, 68% of advisors believe robo-advice to be an opportunity. So that's the first encouraging bit. The remaining 32% believe it to be a threat. When asked about the big banks developing robo-advice, only 26% of advisors actually saw that as a threat. So the lesson here is advisors see it as opportunity, but they are unconvinced of the competition that the banks are going to provide when it comes to robo-advice. Now, digging deep a bit further, a plurality of advisors believe that robo-advice will actually increase the total amount of advice revenue to their practices. So we asked them, do you think that the onset of robo-advice is actually going to increase your business or actually disrupt it and decrease the revenue? So 30% of advisors thought that robo-advice would actually increase their client numbers and revenue by increasing participant rates from gold and silver clients. So what they're hoping is going to happen is that their C&D clients will use robo-advice, and those guys might have $10,000 in savings now, but in 10 years they might have $400,000 in savings. And so they're hoping that by engaging with those clients now, later on down the track, the actual face-to-face or the phone-based advice that they give them will actually increase. So that they're hoping that the actual pie will increase. Now, 28% of advisors thought that robo-advice will actually result in a reduction of clients seeking them out for advice as the robos eat into a lower end of their tier base. So I thought that was quite interesting to know what they're actually thinking there. One of the big differences between here and the United States is that in the States, a lot of the what we call large practices or actually smaller dealer groups are building their own robo-advice tools. And here, only 2% of practices are actually even giving that any thought. So they're leaving it to the financial planning software providers or indeed the banks or for the companies you're investing in to actually build those tools for them. So I think that's a huge difference between here and the States and how things are playing out. So I think that's quite interesting. Whether or not robo-advice is going to disrupt the industry, I think the analogy we can use is the comparison of what happened when passive management really exploded in the 80s. Now, the active managers here will attest that they weren't disrupted out of the game during the 80s and 90s with the onset of index funds. And so the rise of, well, the first wave of financial planning in this country was actually as a result of the rise of index management and portfolio management, and it sort of propelled them. And so I think the second wave of financial planning will come from the onset of robo-advice and financial planners being forced to propel themselves to provide high-quality advice at the top end while leveraging technology for their core portfolio management services. And so I think, in my humble opinion, that's what's going to happen there.
John, you got time for more opinion? Then it matters, yeah. So there's a saying that advice is sold, not bought. And you've probably all heard that before. And you have to think back to the history of financial advice in Australia back to the, well, let's say 60s, 70s, 80s. It didn't exist. And there used to only be three asset classes, cash, property, and insurance. And the way that... there was no financial advice really sold. It was very informal. But what was prevalent was insurance sales. So there would be tens of thousands of insurance salesmen selling whole-of-life insurance policies to mums and dads door-to-door with a rate book. No technology. That's been eradicated. But those tens of thousands of people evolved into financial advisors over time as products became much more sophisticated and became more savings and investment oriented as opposed to insurance oriented. So the whole landscape of financial advice in Australia, I believe, has come from insurance sales, and it is sold advice. So when you have a look at statistics, more Australians aren't under any advice whatsoever than are. And you have a look at robo-advice, which is very popular. I believe that robo-advice will just bring out all of the people that don't have any advice. So the threat to a financial advisor is almost next to nil. A bad financial advisor that just builds portfolios out of aligned product, they've probably got no future. But someone that genuinely adds value, that looks at the needs of a family or of an individual for a financial plan, has no threat whatsoever. So I believe robo-advice will be incredibly popular, but it's going to be a very thin segment of advice, and people will still go to non-robots for more full advice relationship, because robo doesn't have much to say when your spouse passes away or you need go and sign some documents or establish some preferential or optimal tax structures. So, again, no risk there for me, for
okay,
advisors.
So I'm not convinced.
You're not convinced?
I'm not convinced. So I think that I want to hear from the financial advisor who's under 30 who thinks that they can really provide something better than a detailed asset allocation model and a full advice suite can give. I mean, where is that financial advisor going to still have value? I mean, besides, yeah, there will be situations like the estate planning you'll need them. But that's estate planning is different. For your typical person with moderate amount of assets, what is the financial advisor?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. But my point was saying that the people with a financial advisor are unlikely to leave that financial advisor for robo. So with Julian's stats and stats that I've seen from facilitated advice is that in one implementation, I think there were 5,000 self-advice impressions on a website of a large super fund, and I think something like 75% of the people that used that robo-advice escalated it to see a financial advisor face-to-face. So you could say maybe that's a poor robo-advice product, and so they couldn't work it out and had to go and speak to someone to sort it out, or it actually taught them the complications of advice, of portfolio construction, of everything that John just said, and needed to go speak to someone.
I don't think financial planners have been constructing portfolios for a while. And so normally a financial planner, when they see a client, it's what multi-manager balance fund from First Choice are they going to use? And how different is that to a robo-advisor? Not a lot. So I don't think there's going to be a huge loss on that aspect. Financial advisors are all about seeing the clients, understanding their risk profiles, understanding their time horizons, understanding their objectives, putting that down and making sure they have a cohesive plan, of which portfolio management is actually only a small part. And so I don't think that there's going to be a huge amount of change in the way things are happening there, because financial planners have been outsourcing portfolio construction since 2000.
So you said they coexist?
Oh, they coexist, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll just throw a thought in there. So where we tend to come at this is we deal with a lot of these really very fresh idea sort of companies. And where these companies absolutely come at it from is what actually does the customer want or need? And I might suggest that the change that's really going on in our industry is actually about working out that rather than being here to be perfectly blunt, sort of serve ourselves and an industry that's really exists to look after itself, we're getting our minds around actually providing customers what they want. So I'll reiterate, I think, what both of you were saying. The business we have an equity stake in, StockSpot, is doing some interesting things on the robo advice front. Their client base are predominantly people who don't or didn't and have a financial advisor, so they haven't replaced that role. Predominantly, they're millennial clients who, frankly, otherwise just weren't sensibly investing, and so it's a service that's suddenly allowing them to access a sort of an automated investment product. That's good for them. But, you know, when they need to start thinking about getting their estate or getting their will in order, probably the first thing, and then think about mortgages and then thinking about getting their estate in order, and then later in life starting to worry about the complexity of the, you know, the pension rules and so on, the role an advisor inevitably has to play there. It doesn't go away. It's that role is evolving to be much more focused on actually delivering very, very valuable advice. The same way as your corner doctor, your personal doctor, his role isn't just to feed you some antibiotics. It's actually to kind of understand what's going on with you and understand a bit about your history and understand where you're up to. And as you go through life, that doctor and that role becomes more and more important. You can't replace that by jumping onto medical ID or whatever the latest sort of health solution online is.
Some of the technology we're seeing, particularly out of a company called Xero, who run this thing called Cashbooks, which we've integrated with. Now, let's just say you're done here today and you go off and you go back to work and then you go out for a bite to eat and then maybe you go off and see a movie later on, Mission Impossible 6 or something like that. Now, If you have an accountant who's using Xero and they've hooked into your bank account, they see in real time everything you're spending. And that's then correlated against something called a chart of accounts. And then it's pushed into our software in real time. So if you were to come and see me tomorrow and I was to look at your fact find, I would know that you went and spent $20 at Event Cinemas and $110 for dinner or something like that. And your fact find will be updated automatically. And so what we're seeing is accountants and advisors now becoming the centre of their client's financial universe. It's not just about portfolio construction. It's about this coaching lifestyle and making sure your clients are on the right track. And it's not just about MERs and ICRs and standard deviations. It's about helping your clients finish their life journey, and of which portfolio construction is only a small part. And so this huge technology change and being able to get this information from one system to another is really something to see.
Okay. Jason, any product placement you want to do, by the way? We have this.
No, I've got a stand out here.
All right. All right, so that was my next question was, Ben, what would you mention? You talked about customers and what they wanted or needed. So that's my question, the next one. And if anyone doesn't have anything that's they're burning to know is what you're creating, your incubated companies, and Julian, your company, and Jason, your company are in a sense satisfying either needs that are on needs that customers have right now, or needs that they don't know that they have, like in mobile. So what is it that you're satisfying? What kind of needs are you working with?
So that's an interesting question. Firstly, I'll highlight for me, but I think I speak for all three of us. When you're doing smaller businesses, you don't have any revenue. You literally don't have a business unless you can come up with a genuine need, because no one's just going to give you money. So you better come up with something that has a purpose, that has a genuine value. You have a disadvantage, and this is a reality of financial services, that trust plays a really big role in financial services. So if you are a small business and you're looking to establish your new proposition and you're asking people to give you some percentage of their life savings, say, or access to personal information, say, that requires a certain level of trust. So you do need to have something that hits a very high benchmark in terms of value. Now, the beauty of that, at least as we look at it, it's wonderfully self-selecting. We're out there looking for entrepreneurs who actually have, one, the resilience and sort of the energy and the focus and the ambition, but two, have a sort of a clarity of proposition, of customer proposition, which makes for what we think can be a successful business. Now, we're definitely not right all the time, and I would highlight we're more interested in the individual and the individual sort of mindset. But maybe, John, tying it sort of back directly to your point is customers, consumers, all of us, we're all customers of financial services. Whether we sort of want to admit it or not, managing your finances well allows you to do the things you want to do, and a little bit later in life allows you to sort of live the retirement and pay for your healthcare and so on you want to pay for. So it's sort of pretty important stuff. The challenge we all have and the challenge of the industry is until you're about, pick an age, I'll use 50, pull it out of the air, you're somewhat disengaged. And that's a real crying shame, because if you were engaged when you were 20 and it's at 50, you work out that, oh, geez, compounding, that would have been wonderful if I'd worked that out when I was 18 or 20. And a few people do, but the vast majority of us only become engaged a little bit later. So a lot of what we see has as its genesis how to get people to actually get engaged around some aspect, be it, online estate planning, or be it peer-to-peer lending or crowdfunding or investment, automated investment. Finding a way to get engagement is really at the heart of, I think, most new business.
Yep. I think the very essence of what we're trying to do is make the very complex as simple as possible. And I don't know how many of you have ever tried to put together a financial plan and you think, it can't be that hard, but 7 hours later you're still struggling trying to get the first three pages out. You've got to get information from a myriad of places. You've got complex calculations. The client may have not always told you everything you need to know. It is a very, very difficult thing, and you've got all these multitudes of objectives and strategies, and they interact with each other, and you've got Centrelink, account-based pensions, self-managed super funds, tax structures. It is phenomenally difficult. And for people to think that robo-advice is going to come and replace all that, I think is a bit of a stretch. But we're trying to figure out, well, how is it we can make all these very complex things, how can we make it simple enough to be able to do on a mobile phone? What assumptions do we have to make? What sort of shortcuts can we do? What sort of tools can we use to be able to get that out and be able to engage with the clients as well as possible, and to try and speed up the advice process? So that's what we spent most of our day trying to figure out. Like, it takes 3 hours and 42 minutes on average to produce a simple scaled advice plan in Australia. And that's a long time. And that's for a single issue topic statement of advice. A more complex SOA can take up to about 5 hours, 5 hours 40, I think it is, on average. And so what we do all day is trying to figure out how can we make that number smaller while keeping the advice, the quality of the advice as high as possible, and to remind, and we've got all these new rules with coming under FOFA with the safe harbour. We've got fiduciary responsibilities now, where, as before, you only had to make your client better off. Now you have to make sure you've considered every single possible alternative scenario and make sure you're putting your client in the best possible position. Now, how do you automate that? It's very difficult. So that's, in its essence, what we do all day, and that's what our aim is, to try and increase the quality of advice and decrease the amount of time it takes.
So can I ask, so how far off are we from having robo statements of advice? Automated statements of advice.
I would say by Q1 next year, you're going to be seeing a fair few of them coming out. But they're going to be single issue statements of advice. So there are three axes of advice, as we generally refer to it. You've got you've got scaled advice, which is single issue advice, and then you've got comprehensive advice. So that's the first scale. The second scale is you've got self-help advice, where someone logs onto a website and helps themselves. Then it can go up to a collaborative advice. It can be over an iPad, co-browsing. You walk into a bank, that they go with it through you. And then you've got face-to-face advice. So that's the second axis of advice. The third axis of advice is you have your traditional approach, where if a client comes in and sees you and you go through all their needs and objections and time horizons, whatever it is, and you give them one risk profile. Right? And that's traditionally how it worked. Now, in the States, you're seeing something called goals-based advice or objectives-based advice, where you apply a risk profile for every single strategy or objective they have. And so what robo-advice is, it's scaled advice, it's objective-based advice, and it's self-help. So it's hit those three axes as it goes down. So I think Q1 next year, you're going to start seeing statements of advice coming out for that particular combination of the axes of advice. Over the next year, we're hoping to see that to be... You're hoping to see self-help advice, objectives-based advice, but multi-goal or comprehensive approach. And I think that's the holy grail, where you can have someone come onto a robo-advisor, do some modelling or some statements of advice. They can either go ahead and implement that, or they can say, you know what, I might want to escalate that to someone over the phone, in which case that information is taken to the phone advisor in a frictionless way, and they can then help or collaborate with the client, or indeed they can move to an advisor and actually see a face-to-face advisor using the information from the robo-advisor. Now, when that happens, I think you're going to hit the holy grail of self-help advice. And so sometime next year, that's going to happen.
Okay. Can I ask, do we have any financial advisors in the audience? Okay. And does anyone want to venture a view on what Julian just said?
Well, I mean, my view throughout this whole conversation is that we've already got robo-advice.
Pretty broadly spread around, but yeah, it gets down to what Ben said, that different people probably have different ideas about what they're describing as robo advice. So, but basically, with financial matters, people really want to have their hands held. They want to be told that they did the best they could. They're executing the right strategy for the long term and all that sort of stuff. And in a lot of ways, well, unless things go terribly wrong, 10 years later, if they got a 5% return when they could have got a 9% return, and it could have made a big difference to their financial outcomes, as long as somebody says, oh, well, that's a good return, you're looking all right, and we'll just ramp it up now or whatever, they're happy. So. Yeah, I think financial planners, and yes, I'm a qualified financial planner. I don't actually do it. I spend most of my time pretending to be an actuary. I was pretty horrified by the financial advisors' kind of situation, because basically there's so much compliance and so much stuff going on, and Julian said, they've got to go and investigate this whole world of investments and all that sort of stuff. So the only way to do that is to basically have a kind of either robo advice or a kind of effective version of robo advice, which is, yes, we'll take down all your details, we'll send it into head office, and they'll put it through the computer and send back here's your portfolio. And yes, I think it is probably complicated, but I mean, the process of adding on other kind of aspects of advice and just pumping it out, and then just having the financial planner just reassure the individual, yes, that's a good way to go. I think that'll get you through, is what it's all about. So in the end, I see kind of it just being a progression where I thought we were largely robo-advice kind of orientated already, with the front end being the financial planner. I don't see that kind of mix changing a lot, because people do struggle a little bit at this time in our history in sort of going, oh, yes, I'll just go to the machine and it'll tell me what I need to do.
Thank you. Okay. Maybe just switching, because Jason didn't get a word in. We'll switch back to Jason. Let's just talk about, switch for a second and talk about what, you know, customer needs and customer wants. Because Jason, you're in a slightly different business. It's not directly.
Back to that question.
You don't use robots directly.
Right. So Recreo, we're heavily involved in the superannuation industry, and whether you've researched that sector or not, but there's $2 trillion in savings in Australia's super industry. The interesting fact is there's 23 million member accounts, so there's more superannuation accounts than there are Australians, which is first interesting fact. The other thing is the bulk of that money and those members are administered on technology that's probably between 25 and 35 years old. And that might mean it's robust and proven, but it also means that all of that technology was built without an online presence in mind. And so what that means today with threats from robo-advice, from build your own portfolio, online transact, self-managed super, is there's more immediate access to information, more immediate engaging tools and features for super members. So at Recreo, what we've got to do, we've got to build a need to get an institutional superannuation fund to leave the safety of no change and poor service delivery on technology that's 30 years old and move to something that's 30 months old. It's faster. It's got a lot more features. They can change and develop product and issue it to market faster, but it comes with some risk. So that's our need. In terms of SMSF, the need that we meet there is what we've built is really a real-time tax and compliance engine for SMSF. So a lot of SMSF is the typical accountant's shoebox at the end of the year. But that's all too late if there are compliance breaches, like you've exceeded contribution caps or you've paid, nanny's fees instead of your investment manager. All those things that we can capture throughout the year and report to the trustee or the advisor on an ongoing basis. With integrated trading, you'll know your capital gains position before you transact rather than, again, at the end of the year. So those sorts of features and immediacy is the need that we meet. And then another fact on the super industry is with those 22 million accounts, only banks offer mobile applications to their superannuation members that enable transaction functionality. So all the industry funds, all the public sector super funds and everything that you see, there are no meaningful mobile apps. You can check a unit price or your personal details and update, but you can't transact, you can't switch, you can't do anything meaningful. And it's 2015. So it's quite extraordinary.
Okay. All right, so it's immediacy that's the need, that it's real time, it's doing things today.
Correct.
Okay,
yep.
I do need a dial here that just shows when people get too far on the product placements out. I can dial it down, but I don't have a hand that long. So give the mic back to someone else.
Gotcha.
It's a fine balance. Let's talk about that a little bit more. Let's talk about that disintermediation, which is either a terrible word or a good thing or both. So disintermediation is just basically means direct to consumer, right? And in a way, that's what we're talking about when we talk about all this, you know, whether it's online sales of anything. In this context, we're talking about financial advice and financial services. Is this is this a good thing? Now, let me just give my personal perspective. Whenever I go to make a change in my investment portfolio, I do it in a two-step process, because what I learned is if I try to do it in one step and I just go on the site and then I try to change something, I always mess up. And I've said, oh, why did I do that? So I always do it, actually. I always go to the site and I look it up and I read it and I write it down, and then I wait for 24 hours and then I go back and actually make the investment change. Because if you do stuff too fast, you make mistakes. Most people do. And for investments, you don't really want to do that. How do you guys feel about that?
Sounds like user error, the last point there, John. But you are touching on an important point there. Investment decisions and decisions that broadly, financial services decisions, let's maybe focus on investment decisions, are supposed to be long-term decisions. That's any amount of literature and any amount of common sense tells you that. But the irony is this we find does conflict a bit with my engagement point earlier, because if your wise advice to someone is make a good, sensible decision on a portfolio, if you let's say you're 20 and you're investing, you're going to have a pretty aggressive growth portfolio and you should next look at it when you're 30. And that makes keeping them engaged quite difficult, because, you know, it's much easier to say, well, actually, here's this fabulous new day trading solution I can offer you where you can get 30 trades a day and the last 29 are free, which is encouraging a whole different set of behaviour and achieving a whole different outcome. I think there's a real challenge there in terms of thinking about how people are actually going to you know really kind of engage around what the solution or product might be.
I think when you ask that question, the first thing I ask myself is, why are we talking about this today? Why weren't we talking about this 5 years ago? Why not in 5 years' time? What is it about today that brings this to the front of our mind? And there's two reasons. The first reason is the rise of the mobile phone or the mobile tablet or the mobile device. It's the first device in human history that everyone's got that we can access them with. I think there's 140 million computers sold worldwide each year, desktops. But it's 2.6 billion mobile phones are replaced every 2 to 3 years. And these are smartphones, and they're in everyone's pockets, and everyone's got them. Your mums, your dads, your daughters, your granddaughters, everybody. And so it's this ubiquitousness of the mobile device that is changing everything. So you've got that on one hand. In fact, 20.54% of all Australians, the only access they have to the internet is through their mobile phone. So it's 20.54 yesterday. It's probably 20.56 today. It's just going up, and it's only just going to go up. So you've got that on one side. And then on the other side, you've got the increased self-confidence of people to do things themselves. Between 60 and 80% of all adult retail Australians do not seek paid financial advice. And the reason is they think they can do it themselves. And the irony is 86% of those people don't even have a plan in place. They don't do it themselves. You have this overconfidence bias. And so you've got the rise of the mobile phone, and you've got the rise of this self-confidence. And the people who are self-confident want to do it on the mobile phone. And so you've got this interaction effect. And so people are going to demand to be able to do this digitally, and they're going to want it now, and they're going to want to do it while they're watching The Sopranos, and they're going to be upset when they can't.
Okay, so isn't this a recipe for disaster? I mean,
I think it's a recipe for happiness. No, I think there'll be processes in place where, for instance, there is one super fund where you can only limit the amount of switches you can do to twice a quarter, and so there's limits that you can do. There's processes in place where you can't. You'd have to go and ask if you're doing certain types of advice. A compliance checklist is then ticked, and if it hits over a certain mark, you then have to go and see a financial planner. So there are compliance processes in place to make sure that there are no disaster scenarios. But then again, to human is to err, so it could possibly be the case that you're right. In which case, I won't be answering my phone.
I'm stealing your microphone from Oak. I just had one thought on that. I'll make it up later.
And
I was late. So the Phil, I didn't apologise. Sorry.
The philosophical view as to whether the state, the Australian government, should not have a super system, should look after all the money and pay us all the pension when we retire, was decided back in 85, whenever superannuation came in, compulsory superannuation in Australia. So philosophically, we have collectively voted on and decided that independence around your financial future is something we want. So to your question, John, I sort of hear your point about recipe for disaster. But in the same way as you make your own medical decisions, in the same way as you make your all sorts of important decisions, and I don't think we should look at financial affairs in a particularly different way. I think that independence, ability to make your own decisions, is really important. And if people want to see and to have the ability to transact in a really simple way, then that is something we and others should be providing. But equally, we should be providing the tools, not necessarily as constraints, but as tools to allow people to get those decisions right. So one of those tools is all the financial advisors out there providing a compelling offer, a compelling service that makes people think, well, actually, I might go and speak to that bloke or that lady because they seem to know what they're talking about and I don't.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I'll just pick up on one of those points, but I've got a strong view on this. So, again, because we specialise in the super industry, and I mentioned $2 trillion, the very largest sector of that industry is self-managed super funds. Sorry, John? The risk dial. Yeah, well, you asked me what need we met, so I answered your question. So on this one, I'll go soapbox on this one, though. So there's $600 billion in self-managed super fund, and anecdotally, about 80% of that money is not advised. So that's $400 billion that's just left for people to do what they think best under no advice. So do you stop people from doing that? I look at that, and it's almost immaculate Dunning-Kruger effect. Is anyone aware of the Dunning-Kruger research? Yeah, which is excellent. So basically, it's a psychology research paper by two guys, unskilled and unaware of it. And basically what it proved is that there's a cognitive bias for the unskilled, where they have an illusory superiority that their skill set is way beyond what it is. Conversely, those that are skilled underestimate their own skills and think what they can do, others can do better. But what's proven that if you are incompetent, if you're genuinely incompetent, you're not aware that you're incompetent, and the very skills that you need to make a good outcome, the same skills that you need to work out what a good outcome is. So long story short, the self-managed super fund industry, you've got a lot of people who don't understand the limitations of their capability. They underestimate the capability of others. They don't understand the extent of their lack of capability. It sounds quite harsh. And on top of that, they only learn about their lack of skill after they've been taught. So annual returns and performance may not teach a unskilled person that they've underperformed, but education on how to build a portfolio and how returns work and how portfolios work is more likely to change the behaviour. So given that type of outlook, that is the future of investment in Australia in the current legislative regime. So we've already enabled the largest sector of retirement savings to be led by unskilled in that area. And it will continue on. So what Ben was saying, what you will see is a flood of tools, technology to help these people get on track.
One of the more recent advances we're seeing is the introduction of stochastic tools. Now, previously, if you go on a superannuation website and you do a projection, it's deterministic. There's only the expected return is predetermined, and there's no risk around the mean. So the ones we're seeing coming out now has got stochastic engines underneath them. And so instead of saying at age 65 I have $1.2356 million at retirement, which is great, is that present value, is it future value? That means nothing to me. I don't even understand what that number means. What does it mean? Now with stochastic models, you're seeing, well, Julian, you will have a 46% chance of meeting your retirement goals. There is a 3% chance you will lose a lot due to a black swan event, and the possibility of you overachieving your goals is actually 15%. And so it's, we're moving from deterministic to probabilistic, and we're reframing the questions. And the tools are a lot better for you to see the consequences of your actions. So if you were to increase your expected return or change your risk profile, the expected returns will go up and your illustrations will change, but your confidence intervals around the projections will also change. And so you can see the consequences of your actions. The more risk you take, the more return you get, and vice versa. So the tools, like you say, are definitely getting better, and particularly with this stochastic framework that we're seeing a lot more of, particularly next year. I know of at least six coming out to do with super funds and that sort of thing. So the tools are fantastic.
Okay. Can I just... We have three optimists on the panel, and we have one pessimist moderator, which is me. Can I just see a show of hands? Who thinks that the majority of Australians are going to be able to understand these new financial tools and that it's going to enable them to make better decisions?
I think there's two questions there. One is whether they'll understand it, and two, whether it will make them make better decisions.
Okay, so just the second one then.
Yes.
Okay. Two? Maybe 15. The rest of you are a no then. So the majority thinks no.
Or could be undecided.
Yes. Okay.
So just to be clear, unquestionably these tools are going to help people. I've no question at all about that, because the tools actually won't get in front of people unless they do. So that this is the great Steve Jobs kind of, people don't know what they want until they see it. So until you come up with these new ideas, which these firms and a bunch of other firms are building, you won't know it. But so those tools that unquestionably are going to be valuable to people, I kind of agree with the point. Some people will use those tools to benefit themselves and others won't, but that applies in every endeavour. Was it maybe a question in there?
Yeah, just a question. If I think tools that the ones you've been mentioning, like Monte Carlo simulations, they can come up with a stark visual picture for the client. They don't need to actually understand how many pathways were determined in the calculation of Monte Carlo, if you've done with colours, and they can be really valuable. The question is the valuable part. Does all this robo-advice, is there a sense you're getting about people wanting to change their way or the frequency of how they're billed for their advice? And then will these tools actually affect how they want to be billed or how much they want to pay for the advice? And the different scale of advice, is it robo-tools, do they actually help people better understand how much they want to pay or how they want to pay or when they want to pay?
Well, it's an interesting question, and we started, John, you asked a little earlier, and we didn't really get too far into disintermediation. So disintermediation is to me, more about what your question's about. Consumers, retail consumers out there, at the moment, can end up with, through a number of layers, through the nature and structure of our financial system, with what they're perceived or otherwise as being expensive service. Different aspects of that service are actually consumers are willing to pay quite a lot for, and other aspects they don't understand why they're paying that sum of money for. So disintermediation is about helping the consumer or creating a clearer alignment for the consumer between this is what I'm paying, this is what I'm getting. And will a consumer sit down with a effective financial advisor and discuss in detail different aspects of their personal affairs and actually pay the sort of money they pay a, you know, a lawyer or a doctor for that service? Absolutely. I'm convinced that financial advisors have a healthy ongoing future, but it'll be around providing a high-end quality service. Things like simple tools, which in a very functional way, using colours and so on, help people sort of see, say you're talking about an ETF portfolio with an active asset allocation overlay, will help people see that, and they won't expect to pay a lot of money for that because they'll recognise that that's actually a really automated solution that can be applied across lots and lots of people and done very cheaply. And that'll be where the competitive market takes it. But still perhaps higher than people think. I don't think retail consumers are sitting there saying, I want this for 7 basis points. I think retail consumers, I'm generalising a bit, are perfectly happy to pay 50, 100 basis points for an investment solution that makes sense to them, that they see and understand and is very clear. So to me, the disintermediation is how pricing starts to break down. I don't know what you think.
I'd agree with just about everything you said there. I think all these robo-advice tools, they're going to be very transactionary. And so you only pay on a transaction rather than financial planners having retainers or a fee-for-service model. So they're going to be cheap. And a lot of them are going to be at cost or even free. It could be the case that super funds give you 4 free switches a year and you can do that online yourself. It may be the case that you get 1 free transition retirement review yourself a year. It does an automatic portfolio review and it's just for free. So I think it's going to not only change the way financial advice is paid for, it's going to completely decimate some advice costs as at that lower C&D levels. I'd expect a lot to be at cost or even free.
John, you want to get to another question or keep going on this? Well, just sort of talking about the disintermediation. So again, I look at most Australians aren't under any advice, and I don't think that's a cost issue. I think you look at new generation, how they look at or how they transact, how they spend their money, how they interact with people, relationships. It's very different to older generations. So I think if you were trying to sell or influence someone in their 20s about traditional portfolio construction, asset allocation and product selection and how to manage that, I think you're going to lose, come last, or actually have no traction with that customer whatsoever. So price doesn't even come into it. You've got, therefore, people moving through and their idea of asset allocation or portfolio construction will be I want exposure to fashion, technology, biotech, and construct portfolios that way, completely wrong to how we know it and would normally do it. But they have access to those tools now, have direct access to markets on a very, very cheap basis. So there's just no barrier, and you're not going to stop the people from going there. So I don't think you need safety barriers, but there'll be a heap of providers trying to influence and trying to promote acquisition of those asset classes and provide the tools to facilitate it, right or wrong. Some of those products and facilitation processes will be expensive, absolutely. But even we see it now in a lot of SMSFs that, you know, people want to buy very specific assets, Facebook, Apple, want exposure to technology by Apple, but is that equity or are you buying an Apple kangaroo bond? I mean, there's so many different exposures to that asset type. And on it goes. So it's really a floodgate. So my point before about nothing will happen to the existing advisors, it's the unadvised already that are just going to go in a completely different direction with a whole new language of investment. Balanced investment option just doesn't cut it anymore.
Two questions.
I guess I was actually more going to add to the conversation, being an advisor myself. I certainly agree with you wholeheartedly around certainly the super fund market, but there's a lot of people in there who just don't actually want advice. They're happy to do their own things. I've used like the Monte Carlo type portfolios with some of my high-end clients, and in fact, working out and applying the pool to retire, then to the point where he's got a 10% chance to run down money, and he just being the whole framework around his retirement decision. And like, he's in the point where he's asking, should I be paying him more money? So it's kind of like, I don't see those type of tools and actually taking away from the experience. It's kind of like, you just sort of use them in terms of what age you're actually engaging with your clients.
Yep, yep. The self-managed super fund is a real big, I think, the growth area for the next 10 years. I think March 2014 was the first time Australia had 1 million self-managed superannuation fund members, and that's quite an astounding number. I think the game has changed, and it's not so much financial advisors that I wonder about, it's the platforms and the platform vehicles. Platforms are around because of the custodial features, the consolidated reporting, and the cash management, and the access to a whole range of investment options that you get at low prices for planners. And self-managed super funds are all about control, liquidity, and transparency. It's just completely different from the platforms. And so it's the platforms I'll be looking at very closely over the next 10 years to find out whether they're going to be disrupted versus the financial planners. Planners will always have a role. It's these platforms that I really am quite interested to see how all that plays out. Platforms have been hit hard in the last few years because of FOFA. 55% of their research and development went into compliance over the last 2 years. And with FOFA over, it'll be interesting to see what sort of reactions or how they start to combat some of these self-managed super funds as they plow back more of their money into new features and new benefits for their clients, I guess.
I'm just going to ask one more question. If we could just hold the questions to the end. I know people have a place to go. 20 words or less, the big picture, 10 years from now, who's going to win, who's going to lose, what will the financial investment advice landscape?
It's hard for me to pick the winner, but I know the cake's going to be bigger. I know that the slices are going to be about the same for robo-advice, self-managed super funds, and financial planners equally. But the cake's definitely going to be bigger. And I think all Australians are going to be benefiting from the increased focus of financial advice. And I think the breadth and the depth of advice will be in a much better position than it is now in 10 years.
Okay, so 10 years from now, right, so we'll be looking back laughing at the financial technology boom of 2014-15. But laughing at that and then saying, look at all the good things that came out of it, and there'll be a couple of huge winners. So I would sit and say that SMSF will have easily more than half of superannuation money in Australia. So that will be the emerging sector. It could be legislated against, but that's unlikely. So therefore, that's the rise of the self-directed investor. That doesn't mean the death of the advisor at all. It's just that the growth of number of people under advice with financial advisors, it just doesn't grow so fast. So slow grow. Platforms, I will say that they're dead. So there's just no need. So anything you can get on a platform, you can get directly without a custodian, without any other licensing structure. So you can replicate anything on a platform for 100 basis points less, easy. So that'd be a loser. Banks, they'll keep winning. It'll be fine. Just sheer scale of distribution. Industry super funds, as they are, they're just sort of just falling behind self-managed super funds in terms of size.
I'll be controversial.
So at least one industry fund will have demutualised. And will be listed on the ASX. And so the industry funds they'll all go down a much more commercial sort of path and become much more I'll hold back from saying like banks, I don't really mean that, but they'll become much more.
Asset management space / wealth space at least as big, very much on a peer with the banks and AMP that does exist today, where it does exist today. And I think the dynamic will move around. I agree the banks will still be there in one form or another. It might not be the world. The world will have changed. It will be a much bigger pie. There'll be some really big winners, advisors, both right. It will, and I think we'll laugh when we look back at a conversation like this and we sort of thought about how much is really going to change. I think it'll change in ways like the introduction of smartphone, the introduction of mobile phones, et cetera, that we just can't conceive.
Do you think there'll be a new entrant to financial services that dominates the
I think better than 50% chance the biggest player in the Australian market in the world doesn't exist today or isn't in financial services.
I just wanted to ask a slightly different question, talking about innovation and investment. What happened when we talked about innovation and actually investment product and maybe the word product and structure? Can go with it for Apple and have new retail? I guess it's going to be access to operate with this fine network, this technical process. What kind of innovation do you think will happen to investment product and say,
So we've seen a lot of that. So the barriers to some of that product for instance, with platforms, you could access direct gold bullion within a super fund to a platform, have that delivered a Chubb security box in New York, Singapore, or Tullamarine in Melbourne, and have it insured. Retail, or you could get delivered to your house. So that's buying and selling physical metals. Institutional wholesale hedge funds, international, again, have been broken down and syndicated so that individuals or retail customers can get to those wholesale or large scale hedge funds, international hedge funds that could never get it before. And even direct property, even with fractional property, that individuals can get exposure again, if it's a good product or not. You can get access to direct property units within the unit. So the barriers and again, technology is just making that investment access and less direct. Much shorter.
I think Jason, you've just answered my question on the Apple platform and services, which is very interesting observation. Coming from this, what you just said, I'm from an institutional side. I'm coming up with a lot of regulations on this place. What makes you think that it's not coming to that way with all the technology that's been invented and tools that are coming up? Do you not see the regulations coming that way to protect consumers and to avoid people going into hedge funds and all sorts of ways? Because at the moment they're targeting the institutions.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're not going to the individual nutmegs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And stop these innovations?
No, that's a very good question. So the first part of that is that regulation and controls over intermediaries and investment managers and investment product. I like to call it the blanding, or putting the product in a blender. The edge of those products and that product delivery, it just gets diminished. So the language, the way it's sold, how it's remunerated, it springs it right in, and it loses its appeal. And that somewhat pushes people into these channels that are direct, because people want to something that's more entertaining or has more upside or is sold differently, so they go there. So regulation has pushed people into that to an extent. So therefore, so the regulators will definitely catch up with direct consumption of investment product and how that's different. So all of this technology that we're talking about today, they've got a bit of a head start. constantly, and that's a good thing. But I do see the regulator chasing it down at some point. But interestingly, even in my personal environment, we offer a joint, not a cell. So we offer a cloud-based solution to institutions that cut costs, build efficiency, but our first institutional client was unable to have a cloud-hosted service because the regulator disallowed it, and their international consultant told them, yeah, you can't do it, but when you do it, just do it first. It's just blocking an institution moving forward. Again, bringing people to check out and move into these more discreet personal channels, but it's just hard to regulate individuals. We haven't seen it in SMSF for 15 years, but we always hear rumors about just chopping down on property and leverage. I think if you start seeing that in SMSF, like some new regulation by the ATO, then elsewhere it's going to come fast. But I'd say you have a head start for a couple of seasons.
Other questions?
You ready?
Liz said she was recording this, but it might sort of back up a bit. I was just trying to make the point that there's definitely not dead. So what's dead is perhaps their growth that they've enjoyed historically. And so they're not dead, but what a savvy individual investor will do is be able to find what you traditionally get on the platform elsewhere. The best example of that is managed funds. So you get a wholesale managed fund instead of the right application form, send it off in the mail to check your unit certificate. Then you could do that through a platform, buy and sell units on the platform. But now you can get exposure to the same investment strategy through the ASX M fund issue. So they've just got settlement service for units, so to speak, through the ASX. So you don't need to do that. AMP strategy one, HEDPA.
That's what the family broker was supporting HEDPA.
There are a few, and I know that one broker has 50% market share of HEDPA.
But new money is going to platforms was 84% of the time. That sounds interesting. So we're keeping that. So, interesting, though, overall satisfaction.
GFC was a big move, people going, my advisor, I'm going to lose the money, I'm going to lose my own money, and I'm going to have a cost to lose more. Obviously, account balances are rising, we're seeing a lot of new people coming into this sort of sector. How do you see in the future, when there is some sort of market event, do you think people will go, well, I've lost my own money, I shouldn't have done that, or, and maybe I'll go back the other way again, or it's I lost my own money, and I'll just keep doing what I do?
We'll all have on that. I think people will, most people do the latter, which is cruel heads, but I don't think that's doing it. Repeat, I'm unfortunately that's a good idea.
Did you
have an
idea? Anything I'd add to that, I think that's right, I think that's the human instinctive response. But, so if you're now trying to develop your smart new product and you want to encourage people to come into your retail version of platform or you've got to work out how you can put the machine to the data. See, the beautiful kind of irony here is if you can put them, make 9%, not 5%, or make money, not lose money. You know, that's more money in your product, and that's going to be more revenue for you. So you're all sort of on the same page. The trick will be, it comes back to this idea of tools. And I believe if we get smart enough around some of these tools, and I'm using that really generically because I don't have the answer, but if we get really smart enough around those things, we will help people help themselves. Just on that, so that's your job, question, but what if we flip that to a significant GFC-like event for those people that use the robot ties to construct a portfolio that is really bad?
And is it different to the cash burn that happened in the dot-com era? And how do these ventures move to the next stage of being mezzanine or perhaps listing? And is that, do you view that as a constraint, or really there's just open funding that there's no constraint of the cash burn versus the capitalization of them?
So a couple of different parts to that question. And the guys will both be able to comment, because each business has its dealing with growth. That's what we're really talking about, how you deal with a bunch of growth. But firstly, fundamentally, cash burn for startups today is a tenth of what it was 10 years ago in a dot-com burn bust. And that's because of things like cloud services. That's because of today access to very, very cheap programming services, offshore and so on. So it's remarkable what you can do with not a lot of money. It's remarkable what you can achieve with, say, $250,000 today versus what would have cost you $5 million to get to a genuine proof of concept for that number one. Point number two, it really is remarkable what startups can achieve versus a big organisation. No matter how hard it tried, would allocate, would budget, and would spend to achieve the same sort of thing. And there's no way to fix that problem. That's just the reality of big organisations and being dealing with their structures and so on. So there is an inherent advantage for small organisations. And the third point is the really tough one. And the third point is how you fund ongoing growth. So you've got accelerators, without mentioning any names, who are in the market trying to fund people at a very early stage. And if you've built something that's pretty good and is generating revenue and revenue growth, you will be able to get good funding, potentially from offshore, and once you get up to that, people writing pilots get a $15 million check. It's the bit in the middle that sometimes kind of referred to as the sort of valley of death or sewer, which is problematic, particularly here in Australia. And this is a much broader question than what I'm talking about here, and it's something that needs to be kind of addressed. Personally, and I'm sure you all share the view, financial services is a particular sector where Australia has the bones for genuine competitive global competence. So it is a sector where arguably if we're going to sort of pick areas where we actually become good and become genuine innovators, which means taking the companies right through this phase, this is a sector where we should also be good at agriculture, maybe mining, that's right, financial services is what we should be good at. So it's got to be solved. We're trying to work on that problem. It's an ecosystem thing.
I don't think robo-advice is lucrative as everyone thinks. Some of the partners I'm seeing, or some of the portfolios, they're not a lot, and the
very cheap ETF portfolio as well. So I think it's very interesting.
We're out of time. If you have questions, I will answer them. But just please join me in thanking you.